не пишите.
Ничего не читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Ничего не печатайте.
Inside, you wanna be someone, laying down your pride. You wanna be someone someday, lay it all down before the king. Oh yeah, you wanna be whole. You wanna have purpose inside. You wanna have virtue. Purify your mind. You wanna be set free today. Lay it all down before the King. Oh yeah, this is my desire. This is my return. This is my desire. By you, you wanna be real. You wanna be emptied inside, and I know my heart is to feel you. Do your way.
frisch geschnittenen Wanderstab, wenn ich in der Frühe so durch Wälder ziehe, Hügel auf und ab. Dann, wie's Vöglein im Laube singet und sich rührt, oder wie die goldne Traube Wonne Geister spürt, in der ersten Morgensonne. So fühlt auch mein alter lieber Adam Herbst und Frühlingsfieber, Gott beherzte, nie verscherzte, Erstlingsparadieses
При помощи общего согласия мы достигнем общего согласия. При помощи общего согласия мы достигнем общего согласия. При помощи общего согласия мы достигнем общего согласия.
Your own personal interest in the story. Wanneer herhaal je, Marcus, de grenzen van de gangbare conventie-botsen? Denk ze je eigen instrumentale omgeving te bouwen? Bedenk ze andere luisteromgevingen of slaan ze een brug naar andere ziekenis?
Looking at each other's lips, with no one to see what we did, what we feel. An exciting painting hanging in our unexisting bedroom.
Days out in Rome. Luister naar die woorden. Uit mijn mond. Luister naar die woorden uit mijn mond en toch registreer de echo van hun holheid niet, maar voor de luiken open van uw oren om niet ten prooi te vallen aan de eenzaam van uw isolering, de vreemdheid die in uw hart sluipt bij het zien van de wereld. Die haar handen van u aftrekt. Hoe lelijk van schreeuw zij ook is. En hoe ongehoord ook. Maar als u op het raam uw naam schrijft in het condensaat, kijk niet naar de belettering, maar luister. Luister naar de piepen van de huid op glas. Die heel die oude wereld oproept, van voor haar resignatie, van voor de tijd dat zij besloot zich voor u af te sluiten, haar luiken dicht te slaan, haar slot te grendelen. Ja zeker, het was maar tijdelijk. Daarom ook hebben we ons niet langer langs de landwegen kunnen voorbewegen dan voor de duur van de epoche waarin de kerk het veld ruimde voor de naturen en het onmiddellijk te vroeg om.
Vlak achter en ik heb ze allemaal meegemaakt van dichtbij. Er is al sinds jaren niets ludieks meer aan.
Ja, ik vind het gek, mensen raken vlak nog.
De mensen raken het gewoon door. Met z'n tienen raken jullie hier geprobeerd en zet je dat uit op spullen.
Wat moet je dan? Met een spandoekje.
Met een spandoekje en als je verloren hebt, heb je verloren, makker.
Nee, dat is niet waar. Je hebt niet verloren. Je mag dit nooit verliezen. Je mag dit niet verliezen. Er staat veel meer achter. Want jullie hebben het alleen als een belangetje van je buurt beschouwd. Het is voor het hele land. Heb je een stuk van mij niet? Nou, dat moet je dus lezen. Wij zullen met een eigen partij antwoord moeten geven. Een eigen partij.
Een eigen partij, prima, en dan winnen. Maar niet zo winnen.
Nee, dat zeg ik toch ook.
Nee.
Dat zeg ik toch ook.
Nee, maar dat is wel wat hij wil. Ja. Hij wil zo winnen.
Hoe winnen zo kun je niet winnen.
Maken. Hoe winnen de autoriteiten dan?
Die hebben
vernield, die hebben stuk gemaakt. Daarom is dat gat hier heel. Ze hebben honderden woningen vernield van. De markt vernield.
Vernield
zegt de baldadigheid van de autoriteiten. Zo noem ik hem schouw.
Inspraak.
Dat. Als ik denk dat mensen dat
weten. Inspraak heeft geen enkele zin. Dat weten we. Dat is verloren energie. Wij zullen het moeten antwoorden.
Yeah. Take things the easiest way. fight, I think that you should have knew. I must confess to you again, can't you see that I think it's best to forget you? I had no right to do the good things I did for you. No, no, oh no. Your friends were telling me about you a long, long time ago. Can I hide these aches and pain inside? No longer can I live in this misery. Too much you want to receive, and too much I deceive. So I think it's best you forget me. Yes, I forget you.
Gravity. she retrieved her coat from him and hung it up. While he'd been holding it, he had seemed entirely taken up with this task and oblivious to anything else. Without it, he seemed a little lost and naked, and was forced to stir himself back into life. He turned his big, heavy eyes back on Richard. "Richard," he said, I read your piece in Fathom on music and..." "Fractal landscape," said Richard shortly. He didn't want to talk to Michael, and he certainly didn't want to get drawn into a conversation about Michael's wretched magazine, or rather, the magazine that used to be Michael's. That was the precise aspect of the conversation that Richard didn't want to get drawn into. Yes, very interesting, of course," said Michael in his silky, over-rounded voice. "Mountain shapes and tree shapes and all sorts of things. Recycled algae. Recursive algorithms. Yes, of course, very interesting, but so wrong, so terribly wrong. For the magazine, I mean. It is, after all, an arts review. I would never have allowed such a thing, of course. Ross has utterly ruined it. Utterly. He'll have to go. Have to. He has no sensibilities and is a thief." "He's not a thief, Wednesday. That's absolutely absurd," snapped Richard, instantly getting drawn into it in spite of his resolution not to. "He had nothing to do with your getting the push whatsoever. That was your own silly fault, and you..." There was a sharp intake of breath. "Richard," said Michael in his softest, quietest voice, arguing with him was like getting tangled in parachute silk, "I think you do not understand how important..." "Michael," said Susan, gently but firmly, holding open the door. Michael Wenton Weeks nodded faintly and seemed to deflate. "Your book," Susan added, holding out to him a small and elderly volume on the ecclesiastical architecture of Kent. He took it, murmured some slight thanks, looked about him for a moment as if he'd suddenly realized something rather odd, then gathered himself together, nodded farewell, and left. Richard didn't appreciate quite how tense he had become till Michael left and he was suddenly able to relax. He'd always resented the indulgent soft spot that Susan had for Michael, even if she did try to disguise it by being terribly rude to him all the time, perhaps even because of that. "Susan, what can I say?" he started lamely. "You could say ouch for a start. You didn't even give me that satisfaction when I hit you, and I thought I did it rather hard. God, it's freezing in here. What's that window doing wide open?" She went over to shut it. "I told you, that's how I got in," said Richard. He sounded sufficiently as if he meant it to make her look around at him in surprise. "Really," he said, "like in the chocolate ads, only..." "I forgot the box of chocolates." He shrugged sheepishly. She stared at him in amazement. "What on earth possessed you to do that?" she said. She stuck her head out of the window and looked down. "You could have got killed," she said, turning back to him. Well, yes, he said. "It just seemed the only way to... I don't know." He ran at himself. "You took your key back, remember?" "Yes, I got fed up with you coming and raiding my larder when you couldn't be bothered to do your own shopping. Richard, you really climbed up this wall?" "Well, I wanted to be here when you got in." She shook her head in bewilderment. "It would have been a great deal better if you'd been here when I went out. Is that why you're wearing those filthy old clothes?" "Yes. You don't think I went to dinner at St. Sed's like this?" "Well, I no longer know what you consider to be rational behaviour." She sighed and fished about in a small drawer. "Here," she said, "if it's going to save your life," and handed him a couple of keys on a ring. "I'm too tired to be angry anymore. An evening of being lobbied by Michael has taken it out of me." "Well, I'll never understand why you put up with him," said Richard, going to fetch the coffee. "I know you don't like him, but he's very sweet and can be charming in his sad kind of way. Usually it's very relaxing to be with someone who's so self-absorbed, because it doesn't make any demands on you. But he's obsessed with the idea that I can do something about his magazine. I can't, of course. Life doesn't work like that. I do feel sorry for him, though." "I don't. He's had it very, very easy all his life. He still has it very, very easy. He's just had his toy taken away from him, that's all. It's hardly unjust, is it?" "It's not a matter of whether it's just or not. I feel sorry for him because he's unhappy." "Well, of course he's unhappy. Al Ross has turned Fathom into a really sharp, intelligent magazine that everyone suddenly wants to read. It was just a bumbling shambles before. His only real function was to let Michael have lunch and toady about with whoever he liked on the pretext that maybe they might like to write a little something. He hardly ever got an actual issue out. The whole thing was a sham. He pampered himself with it. I really don't find that charming or engaging. I'm sorry, I'm going on about it, and I didn't mean to." Susan shrugged uneasily. "I think you overreact," she said, "though I think I will have to steer clear of him if he's going to keep on at me to do something I simply can't do. It's too exhausting. Anyway, listen, I'm glad you had a lousy evening. I want to talk about what we were going to do this weekend." "Ah," said Richard. "Well..." "Oh," said Susan, "I better just check the messages first." She walked past him to the telephone answering machine, played the first few seconds of Gordon's message, and then suddenly ejected the cassette. "I can't be bothered," she said, giving it to him. "Could you just give this straight to Susan at the office tomorrow? Save her a trip. If there's anything important on it, she can tell me." Richard blinked and said, Yes, and pocketed the tape, tingling with the shock of the reprieve. Anyway, the weekend, said Susan, sitting down on the sofa. Richard wiped his hand over his brow. Susan, I'm afraid I've got to work, she said. Nicola's sick, and I'm going to have to dep for her at the Wigmore on Friday week. There's some Vivaldi and some Mozart I don't know too well, so that means a lot of extra practice this weekend, I'm afraid. Sorry. Well, in fact, said Richard, I have to work as well. He sat down by her. I know. Gordon keeps on at me to nag you. I wish he wouldn't. It's none of my business, and it puts me in an invidious position. I'm tired of being pressurized by people, Richard. At least you don't do that. She took a sip of her coffee. But I'm sure, she added, that there's some kind of grey area between being pressurized and being completely forgotten about that I'd quite like to explore. Oh, give me a hug. He hugged her, feeling that he was monstrously and unworthily lucky. An hour later, he let himself out and discovered that Pizza Express was closed. Meanwhile, Michael Wenton Weeks made his way back to his home in Chelsea. As he sat in the back of the taxi, he watched the streets with a blank stare and tapped his fingers lightly against the window in a slow, thoughtful rhythm. Rap-tap-tap-a-rap-tap-a-rap-a-tap. He was one of those dangerous people who are soft, squidgy, and cow-like, provided they have what they want. And because he had always had what he wanted, and had seemed easily pleased with it, it had never occurred to anybody that he was anything other than soft, squidgy, and cow-like. You would have to push through a lot of soft, squidgy bits in order to find a bit that didn't give when you pushed it. That was the bit that all of the soft, squidgy bits were there to protect. Michael Wenton Weeks was the younger son of Lord Magna, publisher, newspaper owner, and overindulgent father, under whose protective umbrella it had pleased Michael to run his own little magazine at a magnificent loss. Lord Magna had presided over the gradual but dignified and well-respected decline of the publishing empire originally founded by his father, the first Lord Magna. Michael continued to tap his knuckles lightly on the glass. A rap-tap, a rap-a-tap. He remembered the appalling, terrible day when his father had electrocuted himself changing a plug, and his mother, took over the business. Not only took it over, but started running it with completely unexpected verve and determination. She examined the company with a very sharp eye as to how it was being run, or walked, as she put it, and eventually even got around to looking at the accounts of Michael's magazine. Tap, tap, tap. Now, Michael knew just enough about the business side of things to know what the figures ought to be, and he had simply assured his father that that was indeed what they were. Can't allow this job just to be a sinecure. You must see that, old fellow. You have to pay your way, or how would it look? How would it be? His father used to say. And Michael would nod seriously and start thinking out the figures for next month, or whenever it was he would next manage to get an issue out. His mother, on the other hand, was not so indulgent. Not by a lorry load. Michael usually referred to his mother as an old battle-axe, but if she was fairly to be compared to a battle-axe, it would only be to an exquisitely crafted, beautifully balanced battle-axe with an elegant minimum of fine engraving which stopped just short of its gleaming, razored edge. One swipe from such an instrument, and you wouldn't even know you'd been hit until you tried to look at your watch a little later and discovered that your arm wasn't on. She had been waiting patiently, or at least with the appearance of patience, in the wings all this time, being the devoted wife, the doting but strict mother. Now someone had taken her, to switch metaphors for a moment, out of her scabbard, and everyone was running for cover, including Michael. It was her firm belief that Michael, whom she quietly adored, had been spoiled, in the fullest and worst sense of the word, and she was determined at this late stage to stop it. It didn't take her more than a few minutes to see that he had simply been making up the figures every month, and that the magazine was hemorrhaging money as Michael toyed with it, all the time running up huge lunch bills, taxi accounts, and staff costs that he would playfully set against fictitious taxes. The whole thing had simply got lost somewhere in the gargantuan accounts of Magna House. She had then summoned Michael to see her. Tap, tap, tap-a-rap-a-tap, tap, tap. How do you want me to treat you, she said. As my son, or as the editor of one of my magazines? I'm happy to do either. Your magazines? Well, I am your son, but I don't see... Right, Michael, I want you to look at these figures, she said, briskly, handing over a sheet of computer printout. The ones on the left show the actual incomings and outgoings of Fathom. The ones on the right are your own figures. Does anything strike you about them? Mother, I can explain. I... Good, said Lady Magna sweetly. I'm very glad of that. She took the piece of paper back. Now, do you have any views on how the magazine should best be run in the future? Yes, absolutely. Very strong ones. Good, said Lady Magna with a bright smile. Well, that's all perfectly satisfactory, then. Don't you want to hear? No, that's all right, dear. I'm just happy to know that you do have something to say on the matter to clear it all up. I'm sure the new owner of Fathom will be glad to listen to whatever it is. What? Said a stunned Michael. You mean you're actually selling Fathom? No, I mean I've already sold it. Didn't get much for it, I'm afraid. £1 plus a promise that you would be retained as the editor for the next 3 issues, and after that it's at the new owner's discretion. Michael stared, pop-eyed. Well, come now, said his mother reasonably. We could hardly continue under the present arrangement, could we? You always agreed with your father that the job should not be a sinecure for you, and since I would have a great deal of difficulty in either believing or resisting your stories, I thought I would hand the problem on to someone with whom you could have a more objective relationship. Now, I have another appointment, Michael.
Well, but who have you sold it to? Spluttered Michael.
Gordon Way.
Gordon Way? But for heaven's sake, Mother,
He's very anxious to be seen to patronise the arts, and I think I do mean patronise. I'm sure you'll get on splendidly, dear. Now, if you don't mind... Michael stood his ground.
I've never heard of anything so outrageous.
Do you know, that's exactly what Mr. Way said when I showed him these figures and then demanded that you be kept on as editor for 3 issues. Michael huffed and puffed and went red and wagged his finger, but could think of nothing more to say, except... What difference would it have made to all this if I'd said, treat me as the editor of one of your magazines? Why, dear, said Lady Magna with her sweetest smile, I would have called you Mr. Wenton Weeks, of course, and I wouldn't now be telling you to straighten your tie, she added, with a tiny little gesture under her chin. Rap, tap, tap, rap, tap, tap. Number 17, was it, Gov?
What?
Said Michael, shaking his head. It was 17, you said, was it? Said the cab driver, because we're here.
Oh, yes, thank you, said Michael.
He climbed out and fumbled in his pocket for some money.
Tap, 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 eh?
What? Said Michael, handing over the fare. Tap, 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 said the cab driver, all the bloody way here. Got something on your mind, eh, mate?
Mind your own bloody business, snapped Michael savagely.
Ah, if you say so, mate. Just thought you might be going mad or something, said the cabbie, and drove off. Michael let himself into his house and walked through the cold hall to the dining room, turned on the overhead light, and poured himself a brandy from the decanter. He took off his coat, threw it across the large mahogany dining table, and pulled a chair over to the window, where he sat nursing his drink and his grievances. Tap, 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 he went on the window. He had sullenly remained as editor for the stipulated 3 issues, and was then, with little ceremony, let go. A new editor was found, a certain A.K. Ross, who was young, hungry, and ambitious, and he quickly turned the magazine into a resounding success. Michael, in the meantime, had been lost and naked. There was nothing else for him. He tapped on the window again and looked, as he frequently did, at the small table lamp that stood on the sill. It was a rather ugly, ordinary little lamp, and the only thing about it that regularly transfixed his attention was that this was the lamp that had electrocuted his father, and this was where he had been sitting. The old boy was such a fool with anything technical. Michael could just see him peering with profound concentration through his half-moons and sucking his moustache as he tried to unravel the arcane complexities of a 13-amp plug. He had, it seemed, plugged it back in the wall without first screwing the cover back on, and then tried to change the fuse in situ. From this he received the shock which had stilled his already dicky heart. Such a simple, simple error, thought Michael, such as anyone could have made, anyone, but the consequences of it were catastrophic. Utterly catastrophic. His father's death, his own loss, the rise of the appalling Ross and his disastrously successful magazine, and... Tap, tap, tap. He looked at the window, at his own reflection, and at the dark shadows of the bushes on the other side of it. He looked again at the lamp. This was the very object, this the very place, and the error was such a simple one. Simple to make, simple to prevent. The only thing that separated him from that simple moment was the invisible barrier of the months that had passed in between. A sudden, odd calm descended on him, as if something inside him had suddenly been resolved. Tap, tap, tap. Fathom was his. It wasn't meant to be a success. It was his life. His life had been taken from him, and that demanded a response. Tap, tap, tap. Crack! He surprised himself by suddenly punching his hand through the window and cutting himself quite badly. Chapter 15. Some of the less pleasant aspects of being dead were beginning to creep up on Gordon Way as he stood in front of his cottage. It was, in fact, a rather large house by anybody else's standards, but he had always wanted to have a cottage in the country, and so when the time came for him finally to buy one, and he discovered that he had rather more money available than he had ever seriously believed he might own, he bought a large old rectory and called it a cottage, in spite of its 7 bedrooms and its 4 acres of dank Cambridgeshire land. This did little to endear him to people who only had cottages. But then, if Gordon Way had allowed his actions to be governed by what endeared him to other people, he wouldn't have been Gordon Way. He wasn't, of course, Gordon Way any longer. He was the ghost of Gordon Way. In his pocket, he had the ghosts of Gordon Way's keys. It was this realization that had stopped him for a moment in his invisible tracks. The idea of walking through walls, frankly, revolted him. It was something he had been trying strenuously to avoid all night. He had instead been fighting to grip and grapple with every object he touched, in order to render it, and thereby himself, substantial. To enter his house, his own house, by any means other than that of opening the front door and striding in a proprietorial manner, filled him with a hurtling sense of loss. He wished, as he stared at it, that the house was not such an extreme example of Victorian Gothic, and that the moonlight didn't play so coldly on its narrow gabled windows and its forbidding turrets. He had joked stupidly when he bought it that it looked as if it ought to be haunted, not realizing that one day it would be, or by whom. A chill of the spirit gripped him as he made his way silently up the driveway, lined by the looming shapes of yew trees that were far older than the rectory itself. It was a disturbing thought that anybody else might be scared walking up such a driveway on such a night, for fear of meeting something such as him. Behind a screen of yew trees off to his left stood the gloomy bulk of the old church, decaying now, only used in rotation with others in neighbouring villages, and presided over by a vicar who was usually breathless from bicycling there, and dispirited by the few who were waiting for him when he arrived. Behind the steeple of the church hung the cold eye of the moon. A glimpse of movement seemed suddenly to catch his eye, as if a figure had moved in the bushes near the house, but it was, he told himself, only his imagination, overwrought by the strain of being dead. What was there here that he could possibly be afraid of? He continued onwards, around the angle of the wing of the rectory, towards the front door, set deep within its gloomy porch, wreathed in ivy. He was suddenly startled to realise there was light coming from inside the house, electric light and also the dim flicker of firelight. It was a moment or two before he realised that he was, of course, expected that night, though hardly in his present form. Mrs. Bennett, the elderly housekeeper, would have been in to make the bed, light the fire, and leave out a light supper for him. The television, too, would be on, especially so that he could turn it off impatiently upon entering. His footsteps failed to crunch on the gravel as he approached. Though he knew that he must fail at the door, he nevertheless could not but go there first, to try if he could open it. And only then, hidden within the shadows of the porch, would he close his eyes and let himself slip ashamedly through it. He stepped up to the door and stopped. It was open. Just half an inch, but it was open. His spirit fluttered in fearful surprise. How could it be open? Mrs. Bennett was always so conscientious about such things. He stood uncertainly for a moment, and then with difficulty exerted himself against the door. Under the little pressure he could bring to bear on it, it swung slowly and unwillingly open, its hinges groaning in protest. He stepped through and slipped along the stone-flagged hallway. A wide staircase led up into the darkness, but the doors that led off from the hallway all stood closed. The nearest door led into the drawing room, in which the fire was burning, and from which he could hear the muted car chases of the late movie. He struggled futilely for a moment or two with its shiny brass doorknob, but was forced in the end to admit a humiliating defeat, and with a sudden rage flung himself straight at the door and through it. The room inside was a picture of pleasant domestic warmth. He staggered violently into it and was unable to stop himself floating on through a small occasional table set with thick sandwiches and a thermos flask of hot coffee, through a large overstuffed armchair, into the fire, through the thick hot brickwork, and into the cold dark dining room beyond. The connecting door back into the sitting room was also closed. Gordon fingered it numbly and then, submitting himself to the inevitable, braced himself and slid back through it, calmly, gently, noticing for the first time the rich internal grain of the wood. The coziness of the room was almost too much for Gordon, and he wandered distractedly around it, unable to settle, letting the warm liveliness of the firelight play through him. Him it couldn't warm. What, he wondered, were ghosts supposed to do all night? He sat